Okay, as we begin our second part of our prophecy study this evening, we're going to be looking at the coming one world religion, the coming war, the cashless society, and Israel. So we're going to jump in because we have a lot of ground to cover. Hopefully we'll get through it all. First of all, the coming one world religion. And it's interesting, as you read the book of Revelation, it's the one world church that moves the one world government. The woman rides the beast. The church is moving the government. And really, it's the government that turns then on the church and destroys that. But they kind of worked hand in hand for a while. But the church is moving in political affairs. And we see that today, really, worldwide. And it's hard to imagine how Christianity could unite with the religions of the world because they are diametrically opposed to each other. And yet, I scratch my head and in amazement, because it's happening. It's like for years, God has shaken up this bowl where oil and water have been placed in, and now set it down. And you see the false church and the true church separating as all oil and water don't mix. And believe me, guys, when you hear some of the stuff that's going on, you just go, wow, these were solid churches, solid Christian universities. And now look at what's happened. And Jude said, you know, that we have to earnestly contend for the faith which was delivered to all saints. And I truly believe that today. We have to contend for the faith that we believe. Because the apostasy that the church is embracing today is simple. That God has revealed himself in many different ways to different cultures, and thus all religions worship the same God, but just use different names. Jesus is only one way, one of the many different paths to God, even though Jesus said in John 14:6, I am the way, I am the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father except through me. And this view is growing and leading the way as the National Council of Churches in the United States and the World Council of Churches. And these organizations condemn missionary activity as arrogant and anti-cultural. And I'll just give you a little history on this movement of the one world religion. And this is from Recreating Eden, a look at the 2004 Parliament of World's Religions. From July 7th to the 13th, 2004, Barcelona, Spain was the focal point for this year's largest interfaith event, the 2004 Parliament of World's Religions. And while this conference received practically no media coverage in North America, it was a major milestone in a lineage of interfaith events. The history of the Parliament of World's Religions goes back over 100 years to 1893. That year, the first World's Parliament of Religions took place as part of the World Columbia Exposition in Chicago. Thousands attended, and the gathering became a seminal event in the American religious life, quote, marking the change from the dominance of Anglo-Saxon Protestantism to the start of a multi-religious society, unquote. Richard Seeger, in his Harvard University doctrinal thesis on the 1893 Parliament, further elaborated on this national religious turnaround. He said, as far as religious pluralism in America is concerned, a strict construction of the issue would seem to suggest that after the Parliament, there were many ways to be religious. One could be saved or self-realized or grow in God consciousness or be self-emptied. And as America itself continued to pursue its messianic mission, it was a nation under a changed God, Krishna, Vishnu, the Buddha, technically a not God, the Divine Mother, and other deities had been tucked up in the nation's sacred canopy, where they joined the Christian Father and Son, Jehovah, nature's God, and Apollo and his muses. Now, 100 years later, in 1993, the second Parliament of World Religions took place, and once again it was in Chicago. And like the first parliament, this event drew thousands of participants from practically every major and minor stream of thought, philosophy, and spiritual persuasion. Erwin Lutzer, author and well-known Christian apologist, attended this event with a critical eye. Writing on what he witnessed, Lutzer commented, "The gods are on a roll, and woe to those who stand in the way of their agenda. With lofty ideals and utopian plans to unify the religions of the world for the common good, this parliament meant to break down the barriers that exist in the accelerate march towards unity." Setting the stage for deeper interfaith collaboration, the 1993 parliament spurned a landmark directive, the creation of a global ethic. blending various aspects of many religious traditions, the basic idea behind the global ethic was and is to unite all religions around a common core set of moral and ethical values. You see, they've taken Christ right out of the picture. Now it's moral and ethical values. To this end, the 1993 Parliament was especially significant as the drive towards a global ethic elevated interreligious cooperation to new heights. In 1999, on the eve of the new millennium, the third Parliament of the World's Religions took place in Cape Town, South Africa. Again, thousands attended. However, when the Parliament concluded, it was evident that a new direction for interfaith cooperation had been formulated. Unlike the past two events, which had a heavy emphasis on religious unity, the South African conference produced a remarkably political agenda. Titled "A Call to Our Guiding Institutions," the final report from Cape Town stressed the earth-centric changes needed to take place within governments, religious institutions, labor and industry, education, science, the international political community, and in other areas such as commerce and media. It was a call for global interdependence and robust cooperation within the human family. All this was to take place within a framework of interfaith understanding where Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, and other spiritual paths could unite around a better world concept. And then came this year's Parliament of the World's Religions. Peak attendance at Barcelona topped 8,600, with participants coming from all corners of the world and representing an enormous range of religious beliefs and practices. Dirk Ficca, the executive director of the Parliament of World Religions, explained what political interconnections would be sought in order to implement the commitments made during the week. And this is what he said. The Council for a Parliament of the World Religions has also developed a process to monitor and support the implementation of the Barcelona Parliament commitments, including best practice manuals and a web-based communications network in order to support and assess the impact on the world's pressing problems. We are also exploring partnerships with other sectors of society, such as organizations within the UN system, the World Bank, and organizations that promote corporate and social responsibility. I mean, think about that. I mean, the religions are going to unite with the UN system, the World Bank, and other organizations? And here's where the rubber meets the road, a commitment to impacting global political decision-making via the unified lobbying influence of the international religious community. Ultimately, it is man's plan to remake the work in man's image. Wow. You know, we're seeing the walls of our Christian faith come tumbling down around us under the idea of what? Tolerance today. We need to be more tolerant. We need to accept all religions, as the story from the December LA Times says. One of the nation's leading evangelical Christian seminaries has launched a federally funded project for making peace with Muslims, featuring a proposed code of ethics that rejects offensive statements about each other's faith, affirms a mutual belief in one God, and pledges not to proselyze. Now think about it. What university, what Christian seminary would do that? It's got to be some offbeat one, right? The $1 million project initiated by Fuller Theological Seminary in Pasadena is being hailed by both sides as a pioneering attempt to ease continuing conflict. But in an illustration of sharp theological divides, some conservative evangelicals are charging the ethics code and asserting that they do not believe in the same God as Muslims. Yeah, no kidding. Tensions between Muslims and evangelical Christians have been aggravated by a series of negative remarks about Islam by national evangelical leaders since the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks. Those included the characterization of Islam by evangelist Franklin Graham as an evil religion, and assertions by the Reverend Jerry Falwell that Prophet Muhammad was a terrorist, and by the former president of the Southern Baptist Convention, the nation's largest Protestant denomination, that Muhammad was, quote, demon-possessed pedophile, unquote. And so they want to come against this and say, no, that's not true. And then there's this article from DesertNews.com, November 15, 2004. And again, I don't get it. taken the pulpit in the Salt Lake Tabernacle for an evening of friendship to speak of the event's historic nature, Fuller Theological Seminary President Richard Mao addressed a capacity crowd of 7,000, offering a stunningly candid apology to members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and noting that friendship has not come easily between our communities. Here's an opportunity to speak to the Mormons. You've got an audience. They invited you. And he dubbed the evening historic and apologized that evangelicals have often misrepresented the faith and beliefs of the Latter-day Saints. This is what he said. Let me state it clearly. We evangelicals have sinned against you. Adding, both camps have tended to marginalize and simplify the other's beliefs. Historical animosity dating back to the founding of the LSD Church by Joseph Smith in 1830 has heightened in recent years between the two groups, particularly in the 1990s when several high-profile evangelical leaders asserted that Mormons are not Christians. Mao noted the 200th anniversary of Joseph Smith's birthday next December and several scholarly events planned to celebrate during the coming year. He said, I hope many in the evangelical community will take part in those events. Fuller Theological Seminary, don't let your kids go there. I'm sorry. They do not worship the same God that we do. Jesus is not the brother of Lucifer. We are not gods. We are not going to inhabit our own planet and propagate it. Doesn't it make you crazy, guys? You think, am I missing something here? These are seminaries that stood strong for the Christian faith, and now they just throw it all away? And we're forced as Christians to accept all religions, all faiths. We're forced not to be Christian, in fact. Water down our Christianity. Agape Press, November 29, 2004. A Christian group at Arizona State University says it should be allowed to bar non-Christians and practicing homosexuals from membership in officer positions. Yeah. The ASU chapter of the Christian Legal Society has filed suit seeking recognition as an official campus organization without having to comply with the school's non-discrimination policy. The CLS objects to a portion of that policy that would require the group to admit non-Christians and homosexuals as members and leaders. Attorney Joshua Cardin is with the Alliance Defense Fund, which joined CLS in filing the case. He says anti-Christian discrimination has become a trend on college campuses. Universities around the country, including Arizona State University, are starting to reject and remove from the marketplace of ideas the notion that Christian groups should be allowed to stay Christian, Cardin says. In this case, he notes, ASU is requiring the Christian Legal Society chapter to, quote, open its membership and its leadership to everyone, regardless of their religious preference or their sexual orientation. According to Cardin, the school is forcing an autonomous religious group to dilute its identity. And I love what he says. He says, you don't tell a vegetarian club that they have to allow meat eaters or hunters as part of their group. Yeah. You don't tell the communist club that they have to allow capitalists to be leaders and officers in their group. So here in the university setting, only the Christian group is being told they can't require their members and officers to adhere to a set of beliefs. I wonder in the Islamic group if they would let a woman be a leader. Think about that. This is from WorldNet Daily, December 21st, 2004. And you know, I kept getting articles, guys. This thing could have been 2 days long, this study. Bush supports cross-hating movement. Both President Bush and his father have expressed their support for a group of mostly black churches that endorses the practice of throwing the cross into the trash, literally. According to an online column by John Gornfield, the American Clergy Leadership Conference sponsored a nationwide Tear Down the Cross Day for Easter 2003, during which pastors led ceremonies where traditional sanctuary crosses were tossed into dumpsters. Over 100 crosses were reportedly trashed, writes Gornfield. This cross removal movement, leader said, cleared the way for a new age and second Messiah. Though ACLC's website's says part of its purpose is to promote through fellowship the unity of the body of Christ, it also aims to foster cooperation and understanding among all religions. That cooperation is evidenced by the involvement of the Reverend Sun Myung Moon, the founder of the Unification Church, who was dubbed the King of Peace at a coronation ceremony in the Dirksen Senate Office Building earlier this year. So much for separation of church and state there. The organization also works closely with both Muslim and Jewish clergy. One series of photos found on Moon's website, but purged after receiving unfavorable attention earlier this year from evangelicals, shows Massachusetts preacher John Kingera taking down the cross from his church, hauling it behind the old brick building and hoisting it into a dumpster, writes Groenfield. Kingera, embracing the ACLC's new gospel, declared in remarks found in the Unification News, quote, "The fact that the cross is a symbol of division, shame, suffering, and bloodshed prove that it is not of God, but Satan." He continued, "On this 18th day of April 2003, we are beginning a new history. Pastors, please help me to bring the cross down, because it is not of God, but of the devil." Moon was a keynote speaker at the Washington Breakfast last week, writes Groenfield. In Moon's teachings, God himself is shedding tears over mankind. Over mankind's obsession with the cross, which prevents us from recognizing the real returning Lord, Moon himself. I like that, you know, just call yourself God. It's no secret this is something he's patiently explained to many audiences of congressmen and former Republican presidents over the years, in Washington pageants that hardly ever make the news. The columnist says Bush sent a warm letter of support presented at the breakfast by a state senator, in which the president and the first lady sent best wishes to the sponsors and thanked them for rallying his armies of compassion. Can you imagine, guys, taking away the cross? How do you do it? The cross is what it's all about. Jesus died on the cross for our sins. He rose the third day, and now we want to throw it in the trash can? Yeah, it does cause division between brothers and sisters, between parents and children. The cross does divide. But we don't toss it away. We embrace it because it shows us the love of God for us. And I'll try and summarize this with this information from Gary Kaa from Hope for the World from this summer 2004 issue. He says, "The old saying, all roads lead to Rome, has held validity for many centuries. However, with over 1 billion Roman Catholics currently worldwide and with a renewed emphasis by Vatican leaders on pursuing spiritual alliances, this statement holds true more today than ever. While Rome has been the hub of global Catholicism for centuries, more recently, particularly since Pope John Paul II's Assisi Multi-Faith Conference in 1986, the office of the papacy has increasingly become more the interreligious focal point of the world." Writing on the Assisi event, Christian author Dave Hunt explained, "One of John Paul II's most amazing feats was the gathering at Assisi, Italy, in 1886 of 130 leaders of the world's 12 major religions to pray for peace. Praying together were snake worshippers, fire worshippers, spiritists, animists, North American witch doctors, Buddhists, Muslims, Hindus, as well as, quote, Christians, unquote, and Catholics. The Pope declared that all were praying to the same God. On that occasion, the Pope allowed his good friend, the Dalai Lama, to replace the cross with Buddha on the altar of St. Peter's Church in Assisi, and for him and his monks to perform their Buddhist worship there." I guess he didn't feel bad about tossing the cross out either. Several conferences were held in New York City between August 28th and September 9th, 2000, that were moving his agenda forward. And a meeting of nearly 1,000 religious leaders occurred on August 28th through 31st, 2000, to promote the unification of the world's religions, officially referred to as the UN Millennium World Peace Summit of Religious and Spiritual Leaders. It was the first meeting of its type held in the United Nations. And you see how the woman is going to ride the beast. It's incredible. And during that same time, they had a global economic leaders in New York City. the State of the World Foreman and Mikhail Gorbachev's brainchild, Colin Powell, our current Secretary of State, at least for a little bit, I guess till today, tomorrow, huh, was noted speaker at this event. And also in attendance were top media and education leaders with a number of heads of state who've been singled out to address the gathering. This important conference was used by Gorbachev to pave the way for the formal introduction of his Earth Charter in 2001. And then they had a political gathering during that same period of time at the UN, the UN Millennium Summit. And so you got the religions, you got the world government, and you got a political group all meeting. You've got religious, economic, and political groups meeting. We are living in the last days. And we have to earnestly contend for the faith because all roads don't lead to God. And you know what? We are going to look like the oddballs, guys. We already do. Because we believe Jesus is the only way. We're going to toss out the cross. We don't believe all roads lead to God. We believe Jesus is the only way. In fact, Peter said, "This is the stone which was rejected by you, the builders, but has now become the chief cornerstone. Nor is there salvation in any other. For there is no other name under heaven given among men by which we must be saved." It's not Buddha. It's not Reverend Sun Young Moon. It's not Muhammad. It's not Allah. It's Jesus Christ. There is no other way, no other name by which we must be saved except for Jesus. And people may disagree with it, but it doesn't change the fact he is the only way. In fact, the broad way, the liberal road, leads to hell. And you know how that road goes? You know where it goes through? It goes through heaven and leads to hell. Because you've got all these false prophets saying, "Come this way. This is the way to God." And it's the way to hell outside of Christ. Only Jesus saves. Only Jesus brings us to the Father. Case closed, guys. And I don't care if the president of Fuller Theological Seminary says something differently. I don't care who says it. Because I'm going to go by what the Word of God says. Because this is the only guidebook I have. This is what I trust. I don't trust what man has to say. And you shouldn't trust what I have to say. You should check it out for yourself. Because I'm a man and I'm fallible. But God isn't. The fourth topic we're going to look at is the coming war. And you can read in Ezekiel chapter 37 of the rebirth of the nation of Israel from dry, lifeless bones. They were dead. And God asked Ezekiel, "Can these bones live?" And he said, "God, only you know." And all of a sudden, God started bringing life to these bones again. And we see that happening. We saw it in 1948 as Israel became a nation. On the eves of a Holocaust where over 6 million Jews were killed. And God brought them into land. And then in 1967, Jerusalem, capital city of Israel. But that's not the end of the story, because then from Ezekiel 37, you move to chapters 38 and 39. I know, you're saying, what a brilliant guy. But it's true. In Ezekiel 38 and 39, we read of a multinational force coming down against Israel to destroy them, to wipe them out, and Russia is included. And I realize some people say, "Well, you know, how do you know it's Russia?" Well, it talks about Magog. It doesn't say Russia, it says Magog. Magog was one of the sons of Japheth, listed in Genesis chapter 10. And the historians refer to these ancient people as the Scythians. And they lived in the area of southern Russia. And God says, from the farthest parts of the north, and if you take a line from Jerusalem up to Russia, you end up in Moscow. And God says, "I'm going to put a hook in the bear's jaw, in Russia's jaw, and draw them into this battle." You think, well, how's that going to happen? Because Russia is making alliances with Islamic nations. And when the Islamic nations come against Israel, guess who's also going to be involved? Russia. It's beginning to come, guys. It's beginning to happen. And we're told that 5/6 of this army is going to be defeated. Israel will be victorious. But I believe this is what ushers in the Antichrist. Because on the heels of this nuclear disaster, here comes a man with the answers. Now, how close are we? Well, the construction of Iran's nuclear power plant at Bushehr was finished by mid-October this year. It was a collaboration between Russia's Atomic Energy Agency and the government of Iran. And according to Reuters news agency, the plant is complete, except for assembling some security and control equipment. A spokesman for Rosatom, Russia's atomic energy agency, said, "We're done. All we need to do now is work out an agreement on sending spent fuel back to Russia." The 100-megawatt, $800 million facility is due to be launched sometime next year and reach full capacity by 2006. Alaeddin, and I'm not going to even say his last name, head of Iran's Foreign Affairs and National Security Commission, said, quote, "The nuclear fuel agreement is practically ready. If experts agree on a few remaining commercial matters, it could be signed in November." Russia is making the agreement with Iran to retrieve spent nuclear fuel in order to allay U.S. fears that Iran could be making nuclear bombs. And according to Ali Akbar Sultani, I think I made him Italian, Sultani, I don't know, but he's not, Deputy Director General of International Affairs in Iran's Foreign Ministry, said that only a few financing details remained and that they would be settled by the end of the year. While the United Nations is trying to get Iran to halt the project, and Israel is threatening to bomb the nuclear plants if they go into operation, Britain, France, and Germany are trying to compete with Russia and sell nuclear fuel to Iran. Some high-level Russians are worried that these European nations might take their customer away. The European Union's big three offered to help Iran with atomic technology. With Russia in the middle of Iran's nuclear project and Israel threatening to blow up the plants if they go into operation, it seems that the stage is set for the biblical battle of Gog and Magog. It could happen. Do you realize that if it wasn't for Israel taking out Iraq's nuclear power plant, nuclear capabilities, we'd be in big trouble today? But in the 1980s, they did that. They launched some rockets, took them out. And they're also thinking about doing this in Iran, because they realize if they get nuclear weapons, they have no problem using them, because to die as a martyr, you get to go to Allah, so they think. They'll go to Allah, but it's not going to be where they think he is. A lot lower. Amen. And the stage is being set, guys, as children are being trained up to hate the Jews, to kill them. This is not a joke. This is from WorldNet Daily, October 26, 2004. A talking animal on a Palestinian children's television show has advocated starting a massacre with AK-47 firearms. A little different than our Sesame Street, huh? The violent suggestion came in response to a question from a child moderator on the program, which runs on official Palestinian TV, reported Palestinian Media Watch. The recently aired episode was dedicated to the importance of trees. The moderator asked Tara Bishu, a talking chick, what he would do if someone, specifically a little boy, were to chop down his tree. In a squeaky little voice, Tara Bishu answered that he would shoot the little boy with an AK-47 automatic rifle, create a massacre, and make a riot. You wonder why these kids are so violent when they're teenagers? This is what they're taught. As WorldNet Daily reported, Palestinian Authority television produced a Sesame Street-like children's program called The Children's Club, complete with puppet shows, songs, Mickey Mouse, and other characters. Focus on inoculating or teaching intense hatred of the Jews and a passion for engaging in and celebrating violence against them in a perpetual jihad or holy war until the day the Israeli flag comes down from above Palestinian land and the Palestinian flag is raised. In one song on the Children's Club, very young children are shown singing songs about wanting to become suicide warriors and to take up a machine gun to direct violence, anger against Israelis. During the show, which featured children aged 4 to 10, one young boy sings, "When I wander into Jerusalem, I will become a suicide bomber." Wow. Afterward, other children stand to call for jihad, holy war, to the end against the Zionist enemy. You wonder where they get the hatred from? They're taught. In another segment, the boy who appears to be no more than 8 or 9 years old chants, "My patience has run out. All Arab existence cries for revenge against the Jews in Israel." Last week, WND reported a music video urging children to become suicide bombers, and which was removed from circulation last year, returned to the official Palestinian television. The words in the music video are sung by a woman vocalist wearing an army uniform, and the visuals include children in frenzied war dances. interspersed between scenes of children participating in violence in combat zones. Not only that, but again from WorldNet Daily, June 26, 2004, there's a website dedicated to Islamic law, and it features a video presentation, listen, of four children acting out a beheading in a similar manner to recent slayings in Iraq and Saudi Arabia. The video footage culminates with a mock beheading of the child hostage. And you wonder why they're so violent. It's what they're taught. Can you imagine if we had that on our television? I mean, we have lots of violence on our TV, guys. But look at this. This is towards a group of people. And let me put this into perspective for you to show you that this war is going to happen. The Bible tells us so, and the evidence is growing that this war is going to be soon. In fact, I believe it's this war against Israel, like I said, that's going to usher in the Antichrist. As he comes on the scene to solve the world's problems on the heels of this nuclear holocaust. And keep in mind that Israel is surrounded by those that want to destroy them on three sides, and the fourth side is the Mediterranean Sea. So there's nowhere for them to go. And, you know, Dave and Tammy could testify. We were in Israel this year. It's not very big. They're fighting for their lives. There's soldiers everywhere, young kids, I should say, everywhere with their AK-47s or whatever they are, their machine guns. Sat in a restaurant eating, and here's this soldier, this young kid, probably 18 years old, sitting down with his family with his gun pointed at me. Like, can you move it that way just a little bit? But they're ready for war. Because once it breaks out, they got to move, and they got to move quickly. And it's like Ronnie said, we asked him, well, do you have nuclear weapons? He goes, I can't tell you that we do, but I won't say that we don't. They do. And if they have to use them, they will to protect themselves. And you read in Ezekiel and Zechariah, and it talks about their flesh melting on their skin and on their bodies. Their flesh just melting away. It could be like a neutron bomb. I don't know. And it says for 7 years that they're going to have to go and they're going to hire specialists to come and remove the bodies. So it sounds like there's a nuclear event that takes place. A specialist coming in. That lay people, they can put markers down. This is where a body is, but they're not to touch it. Professor Moshe Sharon tells us this. He says, Christians will not exist because according to many Islamic traditions, the Muslims who are in hell will have to be replaced by somebody and they'll be replaced by the Christians. Hello, Dallas, or Fuller Theological Seminary. Did you hear that? The Jews will no longer exist because before the coming of the end of days, there's going to be a war against the Jews where all Jews should be killed. I'm quoting now from the heart of Islamic tradition, from the books that are read by every child in school. The Jews will all be killed. They'll be running away and they'll be hiding behind trees and rocks. And on that day, Allah will give mouths to the rocks and trees. And they will say, "Oh Muslim, come here. There is a Jew behind me. Kill him." Without this, the end of days cannot come. This is a fundamental of Islam. The question which we in Israel are asking ourselves is, what will happen to our country? Is there a possibility to end this dance of war? The answer is no, not in the foreseeable future. What we can do is reach a situation where for a few years we may have relative quiet. But for Islam, the establishment of the state of Israel was a reverse of Islamic history. First, Islamic territory was taken away from Islam by the Jews. You know by now that this could never be accepted, not even 1 meter. So it's not land for peace, it's all the land. So everyone who thinks Tel Aviv is safe is making a grave mistake. Territory, which at one time was dominated by Islamic rule, now has become non-Muslim. Non-Muslims are independent of Islamic rule. Jews have created their own independent state. It is an anathema. And this is the worst. Israel, a non-Muslim state, is ruling over Muslims. It is unthinkable that non-Muslims should rule over Muslims. You know, guys, the war spoken of in Ezekiel chapters 38 and 39 is moving closer and closer to becoming a reality. And you can hear the battle cry. That's how close I believe it is. The fifth one, which I find fascinating, is the cashless society. In Revelation chapter 13, verses 16 and 17, John tells us that he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on the right hand and on their foreheads, and that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. Now, almost 2,000 years later, what John wrote about can come to pass. People will be able to buy and sell without currency. They will have a chip implanted under their skin. And I know it sounds like science fiction, but it's not. The technology is here. What will be voluntary now will one day be mandatory. Every man, woman, and child will be required to have this mark. And today I believe we see a prototype of what it'll be about. And a company marketing them may not be the ones who put forth the mark of the beast during the tribulation period, but we truly have the technology to make this thing work, and it's going global, as you're going to see. This is from an AP report, July 14, 2004, chip implanted in Mexico judicial workers. Security has reached the subcutaneous level for Mexico's attorney general and at least 160 people in his office. They have been implanted with microchips that get them access to secure areas of their headquarters. Attorney General Rafael Mercado de la Concha and 160 of his employees were implanted at a cost to taxpayers of $150 for each rice grain-sized chip. More are scheduled to get tagged in coming months, and key members of the Mexican military, the police, and the office of President Vincent Fox might follow suit. Exceves said Fox's office did not immediately return a call seeking comment. He said his company eventually hopes to provide Mexican officials with implantable devices that can track their physical location at any given time, but that technology is still under development. The chips that have been implanted are manufactured by VeriChip Corporation, a subsidiary of Applied Digital Solutions Incorporated of Palm Beach, Florida. The technology is out there to duplicate a chip, he said. What can't be stolen is the unique identification number and the information that is tied to that number. In addition to the chips sold to the Mexican government, more than 1,000 Mexicans have implanted them for medical reasons. Hospital officials use a scanning device to download a chip's serial number, which they then use to access a patient's blood type, name, and other information on a computer. The Food and Drug Administration has yet to approve microchips as medical devices in the United States. That has changed since July. It has been approved. Still, Silverman said that his company has sold 7,000 chips to distributors across the United States, and more than 1,000 of those had likely been inserted into U.S. customers, mostly for security or identification reasons. In 2002, a Florida couple and their teenage son had Applied Digital Solution chips implanted in their arms. The family hoped to someday be able to automatically relay their medical information to emergency room staffers. The chip originally was developed to track livestock and wildlife and to let pet owners identify runaway animals. The technology was created by Digital Angel Corporation, which was acquired by Applied Digital Solutions in 1999. This is from News Alert, July 12, 2004. Japanese authorities decide tracking is best way to protect kids. And it truly is. It's a great way. The rights and wrongs of RFID chipping human beings have been debated since the tracking tags reached the technological mainstream. Now school authorities in the Japanese city of Osaka have decided the benefits outweigh the disadvantages and will now be chipping children in one primary school so they can watch where they're going. The tags will be read by readers installed in school gates and other key locations to track the kids' movements. The chips will be put onto kids' school bags, name tags, or clothing in one Wakanama Prefecture school. Denmark's Legoland, what a great place to live in, Legoland, but introduced a similar scheme last month to stop young children going astray. Wow. I mean, it's global. Applied Digital Solutions is the biggie right now. From the Boston Globe, September 21st, 2004, global positioning to track sex offenders. What a great idea. Global positioning system and electronic bracelets will be used to track more than 200 of the state's most serious sex offenders on probation or parole starting early next year. Governor Mitt Romney and state lawmakers announced yesterday. Under a $1 million pilot program, Romney signed into law on Friday, the tracking system would alert probation officers when offenders violate conditions of their release by entering an exclusion zone, such as a school, a playground, or the home of a prior victim. Using cellular technology, the system records and sends a record of the exact date, time, and location of the violation via text message or email to the officer handling the case. The sex offender tracking program will be the first statewide GPS initiative in Massachusetts. Currently, GPS tracking of people convicted of various crimes is in place in more than 30 other states. Romney said that the result of this pilot program would dictate whether to expand it to other offenses. The $1 million appropriated will finance the program for approximately 4 months, and Romney will ask the legislator to fund the program for a full year in the 2006 budget. The active GPS system will allow the officer to locate the offender within 10 yards of his location. That's pretty good. With terrorism on the rise throughout the world, listen to what this nation is doing in regards to national ID cards and state driver's license. This is from Infowars.com, December 10, 2004. In a chilling act more reminiscent of the now-defunct Soviet Union or the Nazi regime of Adolf Hitler, the United States Congress passed legislation yesterday that requires that states to surrender their regulatory rights over driver's license and birth certificates to the Department of Homeland Security. Beginning in 2005, the Department of Homeland Security will issue new uniformity regulations to the states requiring that all driver's license and birth certificates meet minimal federal standards with regards to U.S. citizen information, including biometric security provisions. Added to currently existing federal laws and Supreme Court rulings, American citizens, when born, will be issued a Social Security number that will be included on their birth certificates, along with DNA biometric markers. All birth certificates will also be registered in a federal government database maintained by the Department of Homeland Security. No child will be allowed enrollment to schools or be entitled to either state or federal government benefits programs without first presenting a certified Homeland Security registered birth certificate. Wow. Driver's license will also contain DNA biometric markers and include the holder's Social Security number and be required for receiving and applying for all state and federal benefit programs. Major banks and credit card companies have applauded the adoption of a national ID system as being important to counter fraud and increasing instances of identity theft. National ID cards with biometric markers will eliminate them from having to issue credit and debit cards, which for the first time in U.S. history have surpassed the usage of checks and cash. Never before in our history have the words of Benjamin Franklin been so correct when he stated, "People willing to trade their freedom for temporary security deserve neither and will lose both." Yeah, it's happening. And heading the market for this chip, as I said, is Applied Digital Solutions. This is a report from CBN.com, March 26, 2004. Microchip technology is no longer just for Palm Pilots and cell phones. Now people can store important information about themselves right beneath their skin. A chip about the size of a Tic Tac can carry up to 6 lines of text, readable with a scanner. Science fiction has become reality. A Florida company plans to bring their new VeriChip to the market this year. It's a product that excites a lot of people but worries many others. The VeriChip is an advanced digital identification technology, explained Dr. Kenneth Bolton, the Vice President and Chief Technology Officer at Applied Digital Systems in Palm Beach, Florida. It will be the first company in the world to offer the microchip for insertion into humans. Yes, it's in my right forearm, and there's no bump or anything. I think it's interesting that they put it in the right side. Or anything that you can really see. And if you just gently pass your finger over it, it's right in this area right here, Sealing demonstrated. The technique just involves a little bit of local anesthetic into the skin and just a slight amount of pressure. It takes about 7 seconds to do, and that was that. Wear a Band-Aid, that was the end of it. We would like to know for sure as best we can that people in the cockpit of that airplane belong there and they are the right people. The people who work at nuclear power plants are the right people and they should be there, Seelig said. Right now, Applied Digital Solutions sells a separate system for tracking and monitoring called Digital Angel, which consists of a device similar to a wristwatch and a module worn on the belt. It is marketed to the families of Alzheimer's patients because, as Bolton demonstrates, it can locate loved ones anywhere in the world from any PC in the world. Pete is outside and he has the Digital Angel monitored on. And we're going to monitor his position from the Internet Access PC, Bolton illustrated. What we're showing here is he's on the corner of Coconut Grove and Royal Palm Way. And that's exactly where Pete was. Do you really want to be tracked that you're at church? Think about that. A GPS tracking device is currently too large to fit into the tiny Verichip, but miniaturization is probably only a matter of time. Some believe a tracking device inside the body could deter kidnapping. We've had 6 Latin American countries in here in just the last 2 weeks, and they are begging us to create an embedded, integrated technology, Bolton said. But the thought of being tracked and carrying vital information in the body makes a lot of people's skin crawl, and it reminds some of the frightening prophecy in the Bible about the mark of the beast. Revelation 13 says the beast will force everyone to receive a mark on his right hand or forehead so that no one could buy or sell unless he has the mark, which is the name of the beast or the number of his name, and his number is 666. Applied Digital has been attacked by some Christians for making what some fear is a prototype of the mark of the beast. So does this chip as it is now have any relationship to the prophecy in the book of Revelation? CBN News asked Regent University professor Dr. Joseph Kikasola, and he said this, "My judgment is, no, they do not. I think it's both illogical and unfair to make that assertion, and let me tell you why. I think the Bible clearly says the mark of the beast is for buying and selling, and that it is also coerced. It's government enforced. On the face of it, these microchips are for good purposes, like for medical records, like for lost children. They're not for buying or selling as described in the book of Revelation." And Bolton stresses that the chip is voluntary. We live in a free society. You can either elect to smoke or not. You can elect to have the very chip, so it's a freedom of choice. Well, listen to how far we've come from this report, the Seattle Times, October 18, 2004. Implanting a microchip in a pet has become a common practice, but until last week it may have seemed quite a stretch to implant one in a person. On Wednesday, a Florida company announced that the Food and Drug Administration had approved its microchip for embedding into humans to convey information about their medical conditions. Unlike a barcode, which identifies only the type of the product, each RFID tag has a unique serial number. The tags themselves can pack greater amounts of data and transmit the information faster from farther away. In today's closed RFID system, such as those used by libraries, data cannot be shared because only one reader, the libraries, can get information from the tags. Tomorrow's open standards are designed so that the tags can be read by virtually any reader. In the United States, many large retailers are planning to use RFID tags on boxes and warehouse pallets and have started some trials of tags on individual items. Privacy questions arise at the point the tags move from back-end supply chains to goods consumers buy and take home, Rotenberg said. Here's the thing. When you go to stores today, you take all your items out of your shopping cart, they pass it through the scanner, it's got the barcode, it reads it. These RFID tags send off a little frequency. So you go through the store with your shopping cart, you put all your goods in the shopping cart. As you're leaving the store, you don't have to take anything out of your shopping cart. It knows everything you just bought. And then maybe you could use your debit card to purchase all those items. Think of the money it'll save. What a great idea. I don't know if you saw, it was a few years back, and I haven't seen the commercial. It was a few years back where this guy, kind of scruffy guy, walks in. He's got this trench coat on, and, you know, he looks like he's trouble. And he goes into the store and he starts pulling things off the shelf and putting them in his trench coat. And you think, oh man, this guy's going to get busted. And he's walking through the store and he walks out of the store. And then they show a security guard. You think, oh man, this guy's dead. And all of a sudden the security guard runs up to him and goes, sir, you forgot your receipt. We've had that technology today. We're moving into that technology. Forget the barcodes. These tags are the thing that's going to happen. Because of the frequency they sent. And if they put a little tag on each item, and it's not very expensive, they know everything you bought. As I close out this section, we've come a long way in regards to technology. And please understand, the chip is not evil. It's not evil. What is evil is man. And when evil men are in charge or in control of these chips, monitoring people, that's when the problem comes. Big Brother is watching you. George Orwell had it right. And it wasn't with that kind of monitoring device with video cameras, but a chip implanted in us. This is a report from Reuters news update. August 27, 2003, test marketing the mark of the beast. Makers of implantable microchips claim the procedure will be voluntary at first. But a report written by Elaine M. Ramish for the Franklin Pierce Law Center says a mandatory national identification system via microchip implants could be achieved in two stages. Upon introduction as a voluntary system, the microchip implantation will appear to be palatable. After there is a familiarity with the procedure and a knowledge of its benefits, implantation would be mandatory. What John wrote about in the book of Revelation in regards to the mark of the beast was impossible in his day. It's only in recent times that this could be very possible. Now, I don't know if we'll get through this whole section here, and we'll see how far we get. On Israel. If you want to know what time it is on God's prophetic time clock, look at the nation of Israel. In Daniel chapter 9, Daniel is told that 70 weeks are determined for your people and for your holy city. It's for Israel, it's for the Jews. And it talks about 69 of those seven-year periods are going to be fulfilled when the Mashiach Nagid, the Messiah, the Prince, enters the city of Jerusalem. The Messiah comes. 69 seven-year periods, 173,880 days. And Daniel's told that it's from the time to restore and rebuild Jerusalem to the coming of the Mashiach Nagid. So the starting point, if you look at Nehemiah chapter 2, was March 14, 445 B.C. That's when the command was given to Nehemiah to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. And you count off 173,880 days, you come to April 6, 32 A.D. We call it Palm Sunday, the only time that Jesus Christ rode through Jerusalem as Messiah the King. And John, the people wanted to make him king on several occasions, and he moved away from them. Why? Because it wasn't time. There was a day. And then it says he was going to be executed for a capital crime, which he was. He was crucified. So there's a break now. We have 69 seven-year periods completed. There is still one seven-year period to go. You know what that is? That's the tribulation period, where God is again going to deal with the nation of Israel. And I truly believe that the nation of Israel will call upon the Lord, will call upon Jesus, and that will bring him here. You see, Jesus says, I come in my own name, or in my Father's name if you rejected me. But another is going to come in his own name, and him you're going to receive. They rejected the Messiah. They're going to receive the Antichrist. At the end of 3.5 years of the seven-year tribulation period, the Antichrist goes into the rebuilt temple, demands to be worshipped as God, and the Jews go, oy vey, we've been duped. They realize this is not the Messiah. And they flee to the rock city of Petra, where they are protected for 3.5 years. And I think during that time, they're doing a lot of soul searching. In fact, in the rock city of Petra, there's a bunch of New Testaments there that a man put, thousands of them, in these caves. And when the Jews get there, they'll find these and the underlying marks of the Messiah and all that's going to happen. And they will call upon the name of the Lord. And it's interesting when you read about the Lord coming back, you think the first place he's coming to is Israel. Well, no, the first place he comes to is Basra, Petra, in the south. And he moves northward. Why? Because that's where his people are. And he's going to move northward to the Battle of Armageddon, which is not really a battle. The Lord speaks, and the enemy is destroyed. The thing I want to focus on, and just briefly, guys, is the rise of anti-Semitism in the world. It's incredible. You think after what Hitler did, we would learn, but we haven't. This is WorldNet Daily, April 24, 2004. We're told Egypt's government newspaper has accused Jews of carrying out all terrorism throughout the world, including the Madrid bombings. If you want to know the real perpetrator of every disaster or every act of terrorism, look for the Zionist Jews, wrote Abdab al-Wahhab, Adas, deputy editor of Al, and I can't say what the newspaper is, in a recent article titled The Secret Israeli Weapon. The Jews do this to harm and distort the image of Arabs and represent them to the world as terrorists who endanger innocence, the editor said. But he insists it is the Jews with their hidden filthy hands who play their part with expertise in order to harm the Arabs and Muslims and to intensify hatred towards them. They have experience in this area. All presidents attest to this. Their black history is the best possible proof that hatred toward the Arabs and the Muslims fills their hearts and blinds their eyes. They are behind all troubles, disasters, and catastrophes in the world. That's really turning the tables, huh? I guess you don't have to tell the truth. This is from the Jerusalem Post, October 23rd, 2004. The foreign minister canceled a meeting with a delegation from the American Presbyterian Church. Why? Well, because the American Presbyterian Church was supposed to meet with the Jews, but they also met with Hezbollah officials in Beirut. They had words of praise for this organization, this terrorist organization. Gadi Golan, the head of the ministry's Religious Affairs Bureau, said the decision was made after the ministry was informed of the delegation's meeting with Shakik Nabil, a Hezbollah leader in South Lebanon. The Reverend Ronald Stone, a retired social ethics professor at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary, there's another one not to go to, was quoted on Hezbollah's Al Manar satellite network as saying, "Relations and conversations with Islamic leaders are a lot easier than dealings and dialogue with Jewish leaders." Well, sure, they say whatever you want to hear. He also said, "We treasure the precious words of Hezbollah and your expression of goodwill toward the American people. The ones that want to kill us? Goodwill towards us? American Presbyterian Church, where are you going? What are you thinking?" The United Nations also has a smear campaign against Israel, against the Jews. And it was so bad, when we were in Israel, Yasser Arafat died. And the Jews are being blamed for killing Yasser Arafat, for poisoning him. And our tour guide just shook his head. You know, he says we get blamed for everything. He's not surprised. This is a story from Arutz Shiva from December 2nd, 2004. A top PA official has reiterated the end goal of the creation of a Palestinian state alongside Israel. A Palestinian state instead of Israel. In a seeming reaffirmation of the PLO's 1974 Destroy Israel program, commonly known as the Phased Plan, FATA co-founder Farouk Kaddami termed the struggle for a two-state solution just a stage on the road to only one state. Kaddami spoke on November 29th when Iran's Al Aram television station. When the interviewer asked Kaddami, "What is the future of Palestine?" the PLO leader answered, "At this stage, there will be two states. Many years from now, there will be only one." You think they want peace? No way. He expressed confidence in the Arabs' ultimate victory, saying, "There are 300 million Arabs, while Israel has only the sea behind it." The basic principle of the 1974 phase plan is that the PLO would struggle to initially establish an independent, combatant national authority over any territory liberated from Israeli rule. That national authority would then be used as a base for continued terror attacks. The final phase of the plan is an all-out war against Israel by all her Arab neighbors with the hope of destroying the Jewish state entirely. You think they want peace? I don't think so. Israel would love peace. And they've tried. They've given them everything they could, and they rejected it. And it's not... Just think of this. I'll give you a couple statistics. I'll try and go pretty quick. Number of times Jerusalem is mentioned in the Old Testament, over 700. The number of times Jerusalem is mentioned in the Quran, zero, nada, not even once in the Quran. Number of Arab leaders who visited Jerusalem when it was under Arab rule, one. In 1948 to 1967, only one Arab leader visited. Number of Arab refugees who fled the land that became Israel, approximately 600,000. Number of Jewish refugees who fled Arab countries, approximately 600,000. We're not really told that one. Number of Jewish states that have existed on the land called Palestine, three. Number of Arab or Muslim states that have existed on the land called Palestine, zero, nada. Number of terrorist attacks by Israelis or Jews since 1967, one. Number of terrorist attacks by Arabs or Muslims since 1967, thousands. Percentage of Jews who have praised the Jewish terrorists, approximately one. percentage of Palestinians who have praised Islamic terrorists, approximately 90. Number of Jewish countries, 1. Number of Jewish democracies, 1. Number of Arab countries, 19. Number of Arab democracies, 0. Nada. Number of Arab women killed annually by fathers and brothers in honor killings, thousands. Number of Jewish women killed annually by fathers and brothers in honor killings, 0. Number of Christian or Jewish prayer services allowed in Saudi Arabia, 0. Nada. Number of Muslim prayer services allowed in Israel, unlimited. I'll tell you what, they have speaker systems all over Israel. It's so irritating to hear these Muslim prayers going all the time. I wish I had wire clippers, but then I'd be in trouble. So, number of Arabs Israel allows to live in Arab settlements in Israel, 1,250,000. Number of Jews Palestinian Authority allows to live in Jewish settlements in Palestine, in Palestinian Authority, 0. Nada. Oh, there's so many of these. Number of Arab countries that have been members of the UN Security Council, 16. Number of times Israel has been a member of the UN Security Council, 0. Number of UN General Assembly resolutions condemning Israel, 322. Number of UN General Assembly resolutions condemning an Arab country, 0. Nada. Something's wrong there, isn't it? Percentage of UN votes in which Arab countries voted with the United States in 2002, 16.6. Percentage of UN votes in which Israel voted with the United States in 2002, 92.6%. Folks, I'll tell you what. Israel exists because God has sustained them and he has brought them back into the land of Israel. That is the only reason. The day they became a nation, they were attacked by their Arab enemies. They came against them. They just became a nation. And the only reason they survive is because God has said they will. The Jews are the apple of God's eye, and he's not done dealing with them. And one day, all Israel shall be saved. The Jews will be saved. They will receive Jesus as their Messiah. And as you see the signs of the Lord's return, that they're everywhere, and they're growing more and more each day, don't let that stop you from bringing the good news of Jesus Christ to a world that is in darkness and to support his people, the Jews. Pray for the peace of Jerusalem. I just want to leave you with this encouragement here as I close this evening. From Rabbi Shmuley Botek from WorldNet Daily, posted November 2, 2004, My Love Affair with Evangelical Christians. And I want to encourage you that you can make a difference in Jewish people's lives. He says, I'm a Jew who is deeply in love with evangelical Christians. Although I am at odds with them on various issues, they today constitute the most potent force for good in all America and the most influential constituency who consistently demands that America be a nation of justice, standing up for the persecuted and living up to its founding ideals of serving as a global beacon of freedom. To be sure, I am devoted to my Judaism. Wild horses and iron combs could never pry me away from my Jewish identity. I have devoted my life to the dissemination of Jewish ideas in the mainstream culture and to bringing wayward Jews back to their heritage. And I pray that his eyes are open to the truth. But I must give credit where credit is due, and evangelical Christians, more than any other group today, are responsible for America being a godly country. Whenever I am in the company of evangelical Christians, I feel completely at home among true brothers and sisters of faith. More so, I feel inspired like I am in the company of an authentic godly host. Evangelical Christians are at the forefront of asserting that religious convictions demands moral action. You cannot call yourself religious unless you act with justice, period. So many religious people around the world have utterly embarrassed themselves over the past few years by condemning the United States for the war in Iraq, a war that removed the world's foremost mass murderer from power. But the evangelicals have been stalwart in defending the Iraq war as a conflict in which America served as God's long arm of justice. When evangelical Christians talk to me about God, they speak with an immediacy and an intimacy which is both inspiring and impressive. To the evangelicals, God is a loving father rather than a distant relative. Oh, if he would only know that God loves him, that he is. Oh. He says, and unlike secularists who love making up their own morality, evangelical Christians humbly submit to the divine will. He says, their men are taught to value women and to work to be worthy of them. I will strongly object to his insistence that those who do not believe in Jesus will not go to heaven and accuse him of spiritual bigotry and religious racism. He will stand ground. And yet I know that he would lay down his life for me, for all Israel, in a moment. It's on that subject of Jesus especially and other related theological questions that I am, of course, most distant from my evangelical brothers and sisters. I've had many televised debates against leading evangelicals forcefully rejecting Jesus as the Jewish Messiah. But for all that, I have never felt any emotional distance from the evangelicals. All I felt is love. Many of my Jewish brethren reject evangelical Christians as dogmatic and intolerant. In doing so, they are guilty of themselves of rejecting one of Judaism's most seminal teachings, to judge a man by his actions rather than his beliefs. Just try and find kinder, more compassionate people who are more willing to assist their fellow man in a time of crisis than the evangelicals. And this is especially true of the evangelical love for Israel. As an American Jew, I have two great loves, the United States and Israel. The Talmud says that what makes Israel unique is that God's presence is a tangible reality in the Holy Land. In Israel, one can sense and feel God's holy presence. And oh yeah, we were there, we did. And thanks largely to evangelical Christians, the same is true today of the United States. God is alive and well in America, and it's primarily for that reason that this great country is so blessed. Guys, let your light shine. They will know you are Christians by your love. It will impact them, and God is working on this man's heart because he's seeing the love of God, the intimate relationship we have with God. But not only for this man, those in our neighborhoods, in our workplaces, in the stores. Let them see the love of Jesus in the days that we are living in, because there's such a warped concept of love today. Let us give the agape love of God to them. When we keep loving people with the love of Christ, it makes a difference. People are watching, they are taking notice. And may we also just keep looking up, because our redemption is drawing near, guys. The return of the Lord. May we be able to say, as John said, even so, come, Lord Jesus, Maranatha. Today, I came back from a memorial service of a dear friend, pastor, father, just a great guy, Pastor Bill Waters from his Oasis Christian Fellowship out in Plainfield. And he's with the Lord. He fought the good fight. He finished the race. It's hard for us back home, back here. I guess our home's up there. We're aliens and strangers passing through here. But one thing Bill did was he loved the Lord passionately, and he utilized the time that he had to make an impact for Jesus Christ. And that's what I'm encouraging all of you here. You don't know how long you have. Use the time wisely to share the love of Jesus Christ with people. As I'll tell you today, in that little town of Plainfield, there must have been 1,000 people at that memorial service from Michigan, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois. Pastor Chuck sent a letter. All these musicians sent letters because Bill was a great musician. Redeem the time that you have. The days we're living in are evil, but we can redeem them for the Lord, one heart at a time. And may the Lord just richly bless you in this coming year as you walk in his love and shine the love of Jesus. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for your word, because as we look at this world, it'd be very disheartening. But your word has already told us that the world is going to get darker. Men's hearts will be more evil. But may that never stop us from sharing the love of Jesus Christ with people. May we truly be salt, a preserving force in this world. Help us, Father. Pour your Spirit upon us and use us mightily in these days. Help us to fight the good fight, to finish the race, to contend earnestly for the faith that was given to us. We love you so much. And just use us in this coming year for your glory. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.